dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We pride ourselves on presenting to you, day in and day out, intelligent people, people who have experience, often in government service, who have a lot of life experience as well, impressive academic and other credentials. And our guest today, for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say, is one of the most exceptional men in those regards. He is a very accomplished government official in virtually every agency of the federal government that touches on national security, including the Defense Department, the State Department, the Office of Management and Budget. He has also served on both sides of Capitol Hill as a professional staff member in the Senate and House, and on a whole host of commissions that he has often chaired, including most recently the Defense Science Board of the Defense Department. His name is Dr. William Schneider, Jr., and I am proud to call him a friend of many years, with whom I have not been in touch for altogether too long, but I'm delighted to be reconnecting with him. He is these days a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and is a Washington-based economist and defense analyst who serves as the president of International Planning Services, an international trade and finance advisory firm. He jumped back into the public eye recently, having served mostly in sort of the shadows of government, one might say, the places that do really important work, but don't get a lot of public attention, with a piece that he published in the Wall Street Journal about the Chinese nuclear threat that is suddenly, it seems, very much greater than we had been led to believe it would be, certainly, than it has been in the past. I'm delighted to have Bill with us to talk about that and much more. And a welcome to you, Bill Schneider. It's been far too long since we've talked, and I'm so pleased you're with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Frank, and I appreciate the generous remarks. And I'd be glad to comment specifically about the Wall Street Journal piece, or as you prefer.
Well, let's start with that, Bill, because it's kind of an introduction to a topic that I want to address with you more broadly. Maybe just a couple of words about how you regard the Chinese Communist Party and its agenda, and then we'll turn to how this nuclear weapons buildup at seemingly breakneck speed is in furtherance of that agenda.
Good. I think it's a very pertinent question and a matter I think would be constructive for us to get our arms around. Like many things in trying to assess what's going on in China, one needs to embed this particular story in the context. In 2017, China had its 19th Congress of the Communist Party of China, and has been perhaps the most important party congress since the death of Mao. Among other things, the 19th Party Congress established a timetable for China to become the world's dominant military and economic power by the 100th anniversary of the founding of the communist state in 2049. And so the Wall Street Journal article commented specifically on a hypothesis I have about the way China is actually implementing this. And they have focused initially on building up an infrastructure for naval shipbuilding that has now enabled them to have more ships at sea than more ships constructed, actually, than the U.S. Navy, and we'll have substantially more by the end of this decade. And so subsequent to that, and the source of my concern in the Wall Street Journal article was the next phase of their investment has been to build up their strategic forces. And this was led by their construction of at least 270 and perhaps as many as 350 ICBM silos that would house the EF-41, the East Wind 41 ICBM, which can accommodate up to 10 re-entry vehicles per missile.
So these are intercontinental ballistic missiles that have the range to reach everywhere in the United States with perhaps as many as 10 different nuclear warheads targeted at different spots.
Yeah, they would be able to it would have 15,000 kilometer range, so it could reach anywhere in the U.S. or all over Europe, for that matter. A matter that's of interest is the same missile is also has already been deployed in both rail and road mobile forms. And so in addition to the silo-based version, they also have mobile-based versions, and they are in parallel investing in a new submarine, the Type 096.
Before we get to that, let me just drill down on this point that you made, but didn't add a detail that is really stunning in terms of the level of effort and investment that they've made. Before these silos were identified fairly recently, and presumably they'd been under construction for some time before that, but went for some reason undetected by us. But there was a really remarkable report done by not just civilians, but students at Georgetown University, as I recall, led by a professor there by the name of Phil Carber, with whom I think both of us have worked in the past, that discovered something that you did touch on in your article. Where are some of these rail and or road mobile ICBMs secreted?
Certainly a pertinent question, and they have had a practice of using tunnel storage for these systems, which in that respect is similar to the way the Russians operate with their SS-27, which has both a rail mobile and a silo-based configuration. So this is becoming increasingly common practice in China and Russia.
But give us a sense of the scale of the tunnel network that we believe they have constructed over the years for this and who knows what other purposes.
Well, I think the tunnels serve multiple purposes, but they have constructed quite a few tunnels in various parts of the of China, in north, central, and southern China, and they probably cover several thousand kilometers in length.
And by some estimates, 3,000 miles, to be precise. This is a stunning infrastructure for weapons of mass destruction.
I think because they're concerned about the high accuracy of U.S. conventional capabilities, that they store a lot of their capabilities in these underground sites rather than leaving them exposed to the possibility of being struck in a conventional conflict, but it does contribute to those capabilities.
But are you saying, Bill, that you assess these as simply stored in those tunnels, or could they be operated from those tunnels as well? Are they, in other words, being moved about in a road or rail configuration? And what are the implications of having that kind of capability for perhaps a surprise attack?
Well, it certainly contributes to their ability to do it, because the ability to strike their ICBMs, for example, that are road mobile, could be located at many points within the tunnel complexes, and hence could reemerge and be used without as so much risk as being targeted in advance.
Or without warning, more to the point.
Yes, without warning. One of the things that I think is important about the construction of the silo-based missiles, however, is most of the construction only began earlier this year. This has not been going on for many years. They have some silo construction that predated earlier this year, but only a dozen or two silos. The construction of the large silo, large numbers of silos, has taken place at three complexes, and say has been on a rather intense basis for this year. And non-government organizations have actually been able to use commercial satellite imagery to collect the details of it. The administration has not yet published its annual China Military Power Report for 2021, which would presumably provide more analysis and commentary on this. But
It may or may not, for reasons that we'll talk about in a moment. But Bill, let me just ask you, as a strategic analyst of great renown, what would be the reason that they would make the investment in both these silos, obviously, but also in the missiles that would go in them, in fixed, identifiable, and presumably targetable locations, when they've got this impressive capacity to have any number of missiles and have them very, very securely concealed?
I think it's part of this effort where China is trying to achieve numerical superiority in its military capabilities. I mentioned earlier their prior investment in naval shipbuilding activities, and now this focus seems to have shifted to achieving numerical superiority in strategic nuclear forces. And in the Wall Street Journal article, I hypothesized that the next step is likely to be in space, where they will try and achieve dominance in military space.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, Bill, as well. But just to round out your sort of assessment of the order of battle, as it were, in addition to this prodigious buildup of land-based nuclear forces, which, as you say, by itself would have the potential to exceed the total number of nuclear weapons that we have under the various limitations of existing strategic arms treaties. What else have they been putting into place, if I can use that expression, with respect to submarine forces, for example?
Yeah, good point. They are fielding a nuclear triad as we have. And in the way of naval forces, they have a new submarine under construction called the Type 096, which will house 12 of their JL-3 long-range ballistic missiles. So we don't know how many of these submarines they will build, but they clearly aim to maintain this practice of numerical superiority over us. So they may build more than the 12 Columbia-class submarines that we intend to build.
So at sea, the conventional forces are rapidly proliferating. Undersea, the same is true. And with, as I understand it, longer range and more capable submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, as they're known. Is that right as well, Bill? And would they have the range to reach us from home waters where they could presumably operate in sanctuary?
It seems to be the capability that they will be able to field. They may not be able to reach it from the South China Sea, but from the areas further north in the within the first island chain, as it's called, they probably would be able to target the U.S. from Chinese operational areas.
And this is a facet of, again, the measure, countermeasure challenge that militaries have to contemplate in the event of war. And if they are indeed able to remain close in where they can be presumably heavily defended, that would give them, you know, a potential advantage, much like these hardened silos and tunnels would for the ground-based forces. How about air power, Bill? You mentioned that there's a triad, as it's called, land-based, sea-based, and air-based forces. What are they doing in that regard, and how much of a departure does it represent from what they've had in the past as well?
It's also an interesting development and shows the way they adapt their capabilities to their needs. They have built a sort of an evolved copy of the Russian medium-range bomber, the Tu-22, which they call the H-6. And the most recent variant of that is called the H-6N, which will carry ballistic missiles. And so it will, even though the aircraft cannot reach the United States with the long-range ballistic missiles that would be launched from the aircraft, they would be able to use the bomber to be the platform to attack North American targets. So it is a comparable capability, even though it's not it doesn't involve the flying over of the target that we have with the B-52 or cruise missiles like we have with the B-2 or the in the future. Of the B-21.
So, Bill, when you put all this together, and then there are large numbers of medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles in the Chinese arsenal as well, many of them pointed at the moment at Taiwan. And again, I want to come back to that topic with you as well. But it seems as though it's no longer tenable to argue as arms control experts and intelligence agencies in the West, notably ours, have for decades, that the Chinese are content with a minimal deterrent capability, that they are going to confine themselves to 200 or maybe 300 nuclear warheads, and we really don't have to worry about it as a threat. What you've depicted here, and in your article, and I really encourage everyone to take a look at it. It's entitled, rather ominously, China Sees Its Nuclear Arsenal as More Than a Deterrent. And the subtitle is equally important. Beijing is adding warheads, missiles, and subs at an alarming rate. The goal is global dominance. So talk a little bit about, you know, how long has this been underway, do you think, Bill? And is it coming as a surprise to the intelligence community of the United States or other experts that the Chinese have so manifestly departed from that, you know, canon of orthodoxy on strategic forces?
I believe the scale and scope and details of the strategic forces modernization has taken many by surprise because of the, as you noted, the longstanding willingness of China to live with a numerically inferior capability to the U.S. or Russia, for that matter. But as I mentioned, this 19th Party Congress in 2017 really has President Xi's implant on it. And in this respect, I believe the objectives have evolved from what we have seen in the pre-G era, where strategic forces modernization was not so important. But now it's becoming increasingly important as China is able to afford to build it, and they have the political motivation to achieve that dominance.
Have we been missing evidence to this point, or have the Chinese just been surpassingly good at concealing what would be evidence of their ultimate design, which is vastly building up these, as you call them, strategic nuclear forces, strategic and theater, tactical forces for that matter, unbeknownst to us? Is this another example of what we're often encouraged to believe is a sort of omniscient intelligence capability in the United States, missing critically important, indeed very ominous threats to our country as they're building?
It's certainly a pertinent question. My observation is that the Chinese tend to be much more explicit about what they intend to do than was the case with the Soviet Union, where what they did was shrouded in great secrecy until it became evident to our own intelligence community. But as I said, this initiative was pretty clearly laid out in the 19th Party Congress objectives of the state. They are now tending to act on it. It's just that many people did not believe what they were reading. They just couldn't anticipate that China would actually try to miracle to do what they've actually done, and that's a real failing. I think one of the points that illustrates how mistaken many were in assessing these developments is when the first 100 silos were revealed, the New York Times thought it was a bargaining ploy for China to improve its negotiating position with the United States in a future arms control agreement. And that clearly is unlikely to be the case. But the disbelief that China was going to field these vast capabilities and to do so rapidly, it has taken certainly the policy community by surprise, and probably some in the intelligence community as well.
Oh, well, I'd say the intelligence community writ large, it would seem. Bill, you have a history of service on arms control related fronts. In fact, among your many incarnations for a time, you were the chairman of the General Advisory Committee on Arms Control and Disarmament in the State Department Arms Control Disarmament Agency complex. When you look at this idea that the Chinese, we were telling ourselves, would be at some point brought into an arms control framework, and they would agree, as the Russians have done to varying degrees, and the Soviets before them, of course, to have certain constraints imposed upon their nuclear forces and have certain verification arrangements set in place. Are you surprised that the Chinese have actually said, you know, we don't have any interest in doing that, and thus far, at least, have firmly declined to participate either in bilateral or trilateral agreements, which makes, and I'd ask you to address this too, if you would, something of a mockery of the agreements that we have undertaken, the restrictions we have accepted with the Russians alone, when there's now this whole other kettle of fish, if I can use that expression, of threats that are completely unconstrained by these things, to the extent that that they actually do impose constraints on countries like Russia and China that don't honor their treaty commitments.
Yeah, it's a good question. And one of the things that suggests that Russia has changed its approach on arms control after the administration decided to extend the New START agreement, but they have changed the approach to fine-tune the New START treaty to a wholly new approach, which they're calling strategic stability, which is an effort to get hold of other U.S. capabilities that are not covered by New START. For example, precision conventional attacks, which they have been concerned about as an advanced U.S. capability that could threaten their nuclear forces. And so they're trying to roll a lot of other U.S. Capabilities into these strategic stability discussions, and of course, to further constrain U.S. Investment in ballistic missile defenses. So my expectation is that when China completes its strategic forces modernization, it may express interest in participating in a strategic stability dialogue of the sort that we now have underway in Vienna with the Russians on these strategic stability approaches, which will be much harder to monitor, verify, and persuade the Russians to comply with, and I suspect with China as well. So I think we're entering a completely new arms control environment from the kind of thing we've experienced since the arms control agreements with the Soviet Union in the early 70s.
Yes. This brings me to another agreement that I'd be interested in your thoughts about. And what we have learned concerning the Chinese pursuit of a particularly horrific form of warfare that was ostensibly banned by the so-called Biological Weapons Convention. And Bill, going back to something you touched on, and again, Bill Schneider is our guest, Dr. William Schneider, Jr., former Undersecretary of State, among other things. You are doubtless aware, and probably long before the rest of us have been, that the Chinese have been rather public about their interest in biowarfare as a means of accomplishing their strategic goals without the destruction of, you know, the infrastructure and the physical space and resources of a targeted nation that is inevitable in at least most forms of nuclear warfare. When you look at what's happened with the COVID virus, I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus, this brings home, whether it was a deliberate attack or not, we can debate whether it came out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, part of the Chinese biological warfare infrastructure or some other part. Again, we can discuss. But what should we be thinking and perceiving as the likely future direction of the Chinese biological warfare program, Bill, given what they've said about it in the past and given what we've been exposed to, some of it funded by Tony Fauci, alas, by the United States itself?
Well, it's a very troubling set of circumstances. And we know that Russia had a longstanding interest in the biological weapons. The Mr. Yezhov, who was head of the NKVD in the late 30s, had been a pharmacist in the pre-revolutionary period and was very interested in bioweapons. And then at the end of World War II, the Soviet Union captured the entire Japanese biological weapons complex that existed in mainly in Manchuria during the war. And they brought it to the Soviet Union, and it became the basis for their own biological weapons program. But the Russians seem to be focused on the use of these weapons as instruments of assassination rather than attempting to cause mass casualties because of the difficulty of controlling it. But Chinese behavior is certainly anomalous. They've had several SARS and other biological catastrophes in China that have spread outside of China, and now the COVID virus has had disastrous worldwide consequences. So its potential as a weapon is obvious, but it's also its limitations because of the difficulty in controlling it have become apparent. And I think this is needs to be a an aim of the U.S. to try and get hold of this problem, because the Chinese may not be the only ones that are interested in creating these kind of capabilities as weapons. You've got an Islamic terrorist movements that might readily be able to exploit this, and you know, we need to get on top of it rather than just taking it as a one-off problem and walking away from it.
But let me ask you, Bill, the problem of controlling this stuff is potentially mitigated by what the Chinese have been doing, we're told, again, by them, to do ethnic targeting through bioengineering of these viruses that they've been giving gain of function, you know, capabilities to. Doesn't that mitigate, or doesn't that perhaps make more likely the further and greatly expanded use of these sorts of weapons if the Chinese decide that they are going to, in fact, go very kinetic, if you will, in their effort to obtain the global domination they explicitly see?
I can't say that it's it couldn't happen. Technology of the applications of biology are changing so rapidly. It's not clear, you know, who would have the advantage and what the how that advantage would be obtained. But the concern is that you may have China or some other entity, a terrorist organization or whatever, that would still try and pick up whatever technology they can get access to and use it for these kind of purposes. I mean, it's an extremely dangerous kind of technology, and we need to get on top of it. And the way in which we've responded to China's involvement in the creation of this hazard is suggests that we have to do better.
To put a fine point on it, the extent to which we've helped them improve their capabilities in all these areas. And Bill, the thing that I find absolutely gobsmacking is that we've been not only helping them in Wuhan and elsewhere in China, evidently, in this kind of whole of society effort to perfect biological weapon capabilities, biotechnology warfare capabilities, as they call it. But I understand we still have People's Liberation Army associated medical personnel and scientists and researchers getting access to our technology here in the United States, and that Tony Fauci's agency has been funding that work as well. This is truly insanity that this is continuing. I've joined the call for his arrest, frankly, because I think this constitutes treason myself. But what are we to make of the fact that we continue to allow an enemy who avowedly seeks our destruction to be able to obtain technology with which to accomplish it at our expense and with the benefit of our own research institutions?
Yeah, there's certainly been a failure to recognize the problem that's associated with having large numbers of Chinese students in the U.S. The previous administration had promulgated a regulation that denied visas to students that came out of the seven PLA-run universities in China. I don't know exactly what the fate is, but clearly for decades they've been studying in the U.S. and in many cases some of our strongest universities and studying these technologies, but also in many other areas that have military applications. And we have not been able to, as a country, to be able to come to grips with this problem. We have tended to have this similar kind of view that Chinese people are well informed about the benefits of democratic societies, that they would be agents for democracy in China, and that has not proven to be the case any more than the notion that if China is economically successful, it will not be a threat to the U.S. It's both of these kind of assumptions have not been built on a foundation of much evidence.
You are ever the diplomat, Bill Schneider, I have to say, and falls to some of us perhaps to make it a little bit more clear that what we have done is, I fear, enable the potential destruction of this country with our own support. And that's without even getting to the fact that we have been financing so much of what the Chinese have been doing, as you say, in part in the economic warfare space, taking down our, you know, small businesses and manufacturing industries and the like. But we've actually been putting money, American pensioners' money, as you know, having spent a lot of time on the economic side of these issues at OMB and elsewhere, to fund actually the People's Liberation Army itself and the Belt and Road Initiative, the colonial empire infrastructure build out and the rest. This is really profoundly alarming, is it not, Bill?
Yes, indeed. And I think the inability of the national security establishment in general to recognize the confluence of China's military aspirations and the way it's integrated with its economic planning, including the Belt and Road Initiative and so forth. I think Mike Pillsbury's book on
100-year marathon.
Got ahead of the problem, but I'd say most of the national security bureaucracy has still not been able to close on the evidence they see of how the China is able to superimpose its aspirations for global military leadership on the infrastructure that it's creating with its Belt and Road Initiative. So you have these forces working in parallel that are building up China's technological capabilities, its outward projection from China in economic terms with the BRI, and then the superimposition of its security and military aspirations on this global infrastructure they're creating is creating a much more profound threat to long-term U.S. security interests than was the case with the way the Soviet Union operated, which was sort of built around the Stalinist notion of socialism in one country and all that sort of thing that did not give the Soviet Union the kind of global presence that China is developing through its converged economic and security interests.
Yeah. Well, I would argue that the Russians just never had the money to do it. As much as the Germans and a few others were trying to help them out, the trust and, Armand Hammer and Don Kendall and a few others like them just were no match for what the Chinese have been able to acquire from us and others through Deng Xiaoping's hide and bide strategy, don't you think?
Yes, they have a much more a subtle approach, and I would say the term that the Chinese frequently use of things they do have Chinese characteristics is probably not misplaced in this context.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Let me turn to another piece of this bill, because, again, it's hard to overstate the degree to which, again, thanks in part to our underwriting, the Chinese have addressed comprehensively what they've characterized as unrestricted warfare against this country. I want to talk about space, but kind of a segue from what we've been discussing to real outer space and their activities there. Talk a bit about this hypersonic glide vehicle. It's been called a fractional orbital bombardment system. Would you agree with that characterization? What does that mean? And more to the point, what are the strategic implications of the Chinese seemingly now having more or less operational capability? It may be mostly still in the test mode, but it's worked twice, apparently, as far as we can tell.
Yeah. Well, we know that the Russians also had a fractional orbital bombardment system, but what they didn't have was the ability of the system to maneuver, or the warhead to maneuver on its trajectory, to make it more difficult to intercept with ballistic missile defense, and it can underfly the early warning system in ways that enable the Chinese to achieve an operational advantage.
What would that advantage look like in practical terms?
Well, there's a couple of aspects of it. One is that because it's a so-called fractional orbital system, it could be flown over the South Pole and attack the U.S. from the south, where we don't have even a modicum of missile defense or capabilities to deal with that. So that would be one advantage. But the other is the maneuvering properties of the system and the ability of it to fly in ways that can't readily be tracked by our early warning system would improve their ability to strike first if they chose to do so.
How about the theory that our mutual friend Dr. Peter Vincent Pry has propounded, that this delivery system may be used for detonating over the United States on essentially no notice, an electromagnetic pulse attack? Should we be concerned about that? Again, if one of the considerations for the Chinese, as we talked about in the context of biological warfare, is not to destroy the place, if they seek to essentially, well, conquer it, yes, but even colonize it and, you know, grow things here to feed a population they can't feed at home and otherwise exploit the resources of this country without laying waste to it all. Electromagnetic pulse, I know you've spent a lot of time over your distinguished career, Bill Schneider. How serious a threat is that, and might this be used for the surprise launch or sneak attack involving EMP?
Well, it's certainly practical, and with any system that evades our early warning system, fractional orbital system could do, yes, they would be able to detonate a device at high altitude that could have destructive effects on the ground. They wouldn't be able to necessarily get everything just because of the difficulties in having confidence that you can really shut down every electronic system in the U.S., but nevertheless, it would be sufficiently damaging to produce to offer another dimension of threat that China could impose. But the combination of a system that is part of a much larger strategic capability should raise our awareness that China intends to pose a comprehensive nuclear threat to the U.S.
And to be the dominant power, I think, goes back to what we talked about earlier, Bill. If you follow the Sun Tzu, you know, tradition of it's better to win wars without fighting them, if you can be so dominant. And as you know so well, Bill, our own nuclear deterrent has really atrophied. Some call it obsolescent. I think of it really as more or less obsolete. And especially in the absence of nuclear testing, I think the confidence that we can have that these things actually will work, or at least remain safe and effective as deterrents, is possibly misplaced. What are your thoughts about that, and how that may be factoring into what the Chinese are believing they can accomplish with this massive buildup in all of these domains?
Yeah, well, my concern is less about the reliability of the stockpile than it is that our nuclear modernization was built on the spirit of Prague, the 2009 agreement with Russia, where President Obama had come to believe that Russia shared our aspirations to eventually get rid of nuclear weapons. That clearly is proven not to be the case. And yet we have a ICBM force, for example, that's reduced by two-thirds from its Cold War level. We had about 1,000 ICBMs during the Cold War. We now have about 400. We're reducing the number of ballistic missile submarines, and the number of ballistic missiles that they will launch will be fewer than was the case during the Cold War. We have fewer bombers and so forth. So there's, I'm concerned about the reduction in the size of our strategic nuclear forces when the combined nuclear forces of China and Russia could be significantly larger than ours.
When you put this all together, Bill, with this other domain that we've touched on, and we can throw cyber warfare into it, I guess, as well as literally the physical high frontier of outer space. What can you tell us about how the Chinese are looking to extend their dominion into the heavens as well as here on Earth?
My belief is that space is going to be the next area after China lays the infrastructure for its strategic nuclear forces, because they are already well advanced in having a capability to put substantial payloads in space. They have practiced a number of technologies for anti-satellite operations, and they recognize that space is the key capability to maintaining power on land. And as a result, they are working on it very aggressively. And you had mentioned earlier the intermediate and medium range ballistic missiles. And one of the things China is doing that we have not done is that they have integrated land-based radars with space to be able to control the sea from land. And in August of last year, they launched an intermediate range ballistic missile from Western China and a medium range system from Eastern China to strike a maneuvering maritime target in the South China Sea. So these kind of things are suggest the ability to integrate space and terrestrial capabilities is really the way to advance military power.
Yeah, and that includes weapons in space, it would appear, as well as the weaponization of assets like their space station and a moon base and more. I mean, this is an ambitious nation with considerable technical skills, some of them obtained at our universities. Arguably, at least some of the technology and certainly some of the resources being provided, perhaps unwittingly, perhaps knowingly, by Americans. That again brings us back to that point we started with. What are they trying to do? And if they are seeking global domination and the removal of us as an impediment to it, it certainly seems to me, Bill Schneider, based on all of the incredible data that you've just been providing and the insights that one is, I think, inevitably going to have to draw from them, that we have to get on a war footing vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party if we are not going to see ourselves at the losing end of perhaps some combination of these threats. We have to leave it at that, my friend. I'm sorry the time has flown by. There's more to talk about on Taiwan and missile defense and our friend Jim Fennell calls the decade of concern. But that's for another day, and I hope it will be one soon, because it's been a long time since we've had a proper visit, and I'm so appreciative of your time today and your extremely informed and thoughtful, well, characterization of the existential threat of our time, as our old boss Ronald Reagan used to warn, every generation is going to have to contend with, and this is ours for sure. Bill Schneider, thank you for your great service to our country over all these decades. It continues, I know, in a variety of capacities, including at the Hudson Institute, and I hope it will continue here at Secure Freedom Radio as well. In the meantime, thank you, my friend. Godspeed in all your work.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks to the rest of you for listening. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.